Open signal, we're going to start in a sec. All right, good afternoon, everyone. This is Thursday, June 18th, 2020, afternoon session of the Portland City Council. My name is New Ted. Carla, please call the roll.
Hardesty.
Aye. Here.
Udaly.
Muted. Udaly.
Is she on?
She's on.
Yeah, I'm here.
Fritz.
Here.
Wheeler.
Here. Hang on, I got to read this statement. I got to find it. Here it is. Under Portland City Code and state law, the City Council is holding this meeting electronically. All members of the council are attending remotely by video and teleconference. And the city has made several avenues available for the public to listen to the audio broadcast of this meeting. The meeting is available to the public on the city's YouTube channel, eGovPDX, www.portlandoregon.gov/video, and Channel 30. The public can also provide written testimony to council by emailing the council clerk at cctestimony@portlandoregon.gov. The council is taking these steps as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic and the need to limit in-person contact and to promote physical distancing. The pandemic is an emergency that threatens the public health, safety, and welfare, which requires us to meet remotely by electronic communications. Thank you all for your continued patience, flexibility, and understanding as we manage through this difficult situation to manage the city's business. And with that, we will now hear from our able attorney, Lauren King, who's going to tell us all about the rules of order and decorum. Good afternoon, Lauren.
Good afternoon, everyone. To participate in council meetings, you may sign up in advance with the council clerk's office for communications to briefly speak about any subject. You may also sign up for public testimony on resolutions or the first readings of ordinances. The published council agenda at portlandoregon.gov/auditor contains information about how and when you may sign up for testimony while the city council is holding electronic meetings. Your testimony should address the matter being considered at the time. When testifying, please state your name for the record. Your address is not necessary. Please disclose if you are a lobbyist. If you are representing an organization, please identify it. The presiding officer determines the length of testimony. Individuals generally have 3 minutes to testify unless otherwise stated. When your time is up, the presiding officer will ask you to conclude. Disruptive conduct such as shouting, refusing to conclude your testimony when your time is up, or interrupting others' testimony or council deliberations will not be allowed. If there are disruptions, a warning will be given that further disruption may result in the person being placed on hold or ejected for the remainder of the electronic meeting. Please be aware that all council meetings are recorded.
Very good. Carly, we have one item this afternoon, item number 494. Could you please read item 494?
Amend the comprehensive plan map, zoning map, and Title 33, planning and zoning, to revise the single dwelling residential designations and base zones.
Thank you, colleagues. Today we continue our work on the residential infill project. Before we begin the substantive discussion of RIP, I want to announce that I rent property in a residential zone. Properties in all residential zones could be impacted by the residential infill project. I have no plans, no intent, and frankly, no ability to redevelop or change the use of my property. However, out of an abundance of caution, I have been advised to disclose this as a potential conflict of interest, so I am therefore doing so. Would anybody else like to do so?
Thank you, Mayor. Yes, I'd like to also declare that I am a renter in an area that may or may not be covered by the residential infill project, but don't anticipate that there will be any perceived or otherwise conflict since I don't own any property anywhere.
Very good. Commissioner Udaly.
Yes, I am a renter, and I do not have any real or perceived conflicts of interest in this.
Very good. Commissioner Fritz, any for you?
Thank you, Mayor. I own property in the city of Portland. These changes will neither benefit or harm me to a greater or lesser extent than anybody else, and therefore I do not have a conflict of interest.
Thank you. As a recap of where we are in the project, on June 3rd, the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability staff presented various concepts for amendments to the proposed draft of the residential infill project and reopened the record for public comment. First of all, I want to thank everybody who testified and shared their perspectives on this significant proposal. Over 2,000 written comments have been received by our offices on this proposal, and we appreciate the time and the thoughtfulness that many of you have put into both your letters and your testimony. Members of the public who'd like to submit additional written testimony may do so up to 8 p.m. tonight by visiting the project website, which is www.portlandoregon.gov/bps-rip. I kid you not. That is actually the URL. So if you go to portlandoregon.gov, you will find that it's easy to find, easier than me repeating what is probably one of the world's most ridiculous URLs ever. Today, we continue hearing public testimony. We will also have some time for my colleagues and I to share our reflections and raise any questions about the proposed amendments. We will not be voting on the amendments today, but instead we will be returning on July 1st at 2 p.m. to give council time to review and consider the testimony for that vote. I will now turn it over to BPS Director Andrea Durbin to walk us through the agenda for this afternoon. Director Durbin, welcome and good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Mayor. Good afternoon, Commissioners. Thank you very much. We appreciate the opportunity to complete hearing public testimony that began on June 3rd. As you may recall, the amendment concepts have been available to the public since early March, and they were moved and seconded on the June 3rd hearing for discussion and testimony. For today, we suggest Council hear from our remaining testifiers before beginning deliberations to ensure we're able to get through the list. Last time we heard from more than half of our 96 testifiers. We have nearly 40 more that had signed up that we expect to hear from today, although we may have fewer people who actually join us today. For the sake of fairness, we also suggest holding testimony to 2 minutes each, like we did at our previous hearing. Following the close of oral testimony, we will ask Council for any clarifying questions that you may have, and if there's more information you need to better make decisions regarding these amendments. We will then return on July 1st for your deliberations and vote on each of the amendments separately. Staff will then develop an as amended draft that incorporates your changes for your final consideration and vote later in July. Before moving on, I'd like to address a few questions that we heard on June 3rd and a few that we've heard since then for the record. The first relates to questions about when the residential infill project is likely to go into effect. As you know, Senate Bill 534, which relates to buildings on platted lots, is already in effect as of March 1st of this year. Several provisions within RIP that relates to compliance with those state rules are slated to go into effect within 30 days of passage, which is a regular timeframe for ordinance effective dates. However, the remaining aspects of this project that address building size, increased housing options, and respond to House Bill 2001 will be deferred until the project has adequate time to be acknowledged by the state and to provide ample time for the Bureau of Development Services to develop supporting materials and training to effectively implement the new regulations. Therefore, the bulk of the residential infill project is not slated to go into effect until August of next year. You've also heard testimony calling for the effects of this landmark legislation to be tracked and reported on. BPS is committed to tracking and evaluating the effects of the residential infill project moving forward. In addition to our obligations under House Bill 2001 to track and forecast changes in household sizes, demographics, and median incomes, BPS, in partnership with Development Services and the Housing Bureau, also tracks and will continue to track net new housing units by housing type, numbers of regulated affordable units created by location, type, size, and tenure, tree removal, planting and preservation data, demolitions and resulting redevelopment, as well as housing affordability by race, ethnicity, income, and age. The Bureaus of Transportation, Environmental Services, and Water all track their infrastructure systems and plan and implement improvements to those systems on a continual basis. In addition, our work in collaboration with community leadership on the Anti-Displacement Task Force is inherently focused on tracking impacts of city policies and programs. The process and systems for those citywide tracking and accountability systems will include our residential zones, which will help inform RIP's impact over time. What the city has not routinely tracked are the number of existing homes that were purchased and remodeled or resold at considerable markup with no added contribution to the supply of housing. This, we believe, is the threat of a future without this project. Maintaining the current tight supply of homes available across almost three quarters of the city area zone for housing means that new residents will have more limited choices available for their housing and are less able and likely to find housing in the development of their choosing. The status quo of housing development in our residential neighborhoods is not designed around inclusivity, and displacement will continue to accelerate unless we create more options for housing in these areas. The residential infill project alone will not end displacement, but it will be part of that solution. Finally, with regard to the development of the state's at the state around House Bill 2001 and implementing rules and the model code, our staff continues to track and work closely with DLCD staff to ensure we remain compliant as these rules and model codes are developed. And it is true that residential infill exceeds the baseline state requirements because it has been tailored to address the needs and issues that are specific to Portland. And with that, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to share these comments and respond to those questions. And I'll turn it back to you, Mayor, to open up for public testimony.
Thank you, Director Durbin. Thank you for your attention to respond to mine and my colleagues' questions and comments. We really appreciate it very much. So Carla, how many people do we believe we actually have here today for public testimony so I can determine the length of testimony time?
Looks like we've got about 20, Mayor.
And Mayor, you might remember, Mayor, we were asked to limit it to two for the sake of fairness because that's what we gave other people.
I think that's right, Commissioner. I think that's right. So we will, each person will have 2 minutes to testify. I also want to remind anyone who may be testifying today as a lobbyist, which lobbying entity you are authorized to represent in accordance with Title II of the City Code. So Carla, if you could help us continue public testimony. Once that testimony ends, we'll begin our council deliberations. Carla, the first individual, please.
The first person is Alan Kessler.
Good afternoon, Alan.
Good afternoon, Ted. Mayor Wheeler, I'm sorry. It's been a long week. I'm disappointed I didn't get video in here. I was going through some old screenshots of things back in the 2016 timeframe on when I started getting interested in housing. And the first thing I came across was a redlining map, which I showed juxtaposed with Charlie Hales at the time was trying to downzone East Moreland. And I was showing it's exactly the same pattern. This is where a neighborhood green was, and we're gonna try and downzone it to keep it just like it is. This is a historic pattern. I was looking at old quotes of the Stop Demolishing Portland people. One like sticks out in my mind, Scott Tice, who's one of the administrators there. Portland is white, it's simple. And if they're talking about minorities moving to the neighborhood, why would they? They don't have any friends there and probably would feel very out of place and probably not welcomed. Just my gut feeling, not calling the resident classes racist in any such way, just that sounds shitty, you know, you get my drift. Looking at another Stop Demolishing Portland person saying that anything affordable is anything under $1 million. Looking at one of Mayor Wheeler's buddies quotes, Robert McCullough, talking about how I paid a premium to live in a neighborhood with trees and lawns and a lot of livable features. And of course, I'm pretty interested in maintaining them. There's another article where he goes on to say that anywhere there's a historic district, that tends to correlate with increased property values. So in that time frame, when I started in this, I was saying this land use pattern is racist. And there was a lot of pushback directly against that. People aren't saying that anymore. The conversation's changed. And the testimony we're hearing now is about it's way wonkier, but that's what racism does. It becomes unpopular in a certain form, and then it chooses a new set of dog whistles instead of sets of euphemisms. I didn't really support residential infill when it started. I thought it was pathetic. We have such a massive need for housing, especially in the inner core, especially in the richest neighborhoods. And it really
time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. Appreciate your testimony. Next individual, please.
Is Ezra Hammer.
Good afternoon, Ezra.
Good afternoon, Honorable Mayor and Honorable Commissioners. Pleasure to be with you, and it's a pleasure seeing all of you this fine afternoon. I'm Ezra Hammer with the Home Builders Association of Metropolitan Portland. We represent 800 companies who work in and around the Portland area, specifically providing low-scale and lower-density housing, including the type of housing that the residential infill project would legalize. I just want to give a special thank you to Andrea Durbin, Morgan Tracy, Sandra Wood, and the entire team over there for their tireless work on this project. I know all of you have been considering many hours of public testimony, and they have as well. So congratulations to the whole team on getting to this point. I would merely highlight the fact that since the Great Recession, the Portland metro region has built 8 homes of housing for every 10 household formations. And that essentially means that households are competing for an ever scarcer resource of housing. The residential infill project will not change this paradigm overnight, but it will be a progressive step towards ensuring that there is more housing available at more rungs of the economic ladder and of different types. In addition to this important project, we also are heartened by the mayor's commitment and the enthusiasm of others to examine an opportunity to create a FAR for fee model that would allow for dollars to be used for anti-displacement work, which we understand is absolutely critical to the city moving forward. So thank you again for your diligent work on this. We look forward to seeing this project pass and to the second iteration move forward as well. Have a wonderful afternoon.
Thank you, Ezra. You too. Thank you.
Next is Candace Avalos.
Hi, Candace.
Hello. Good afternoon. Hello, Mayor and Commissioners. My name is Candace Avalos. I'm a first-generation millennial Black Tina, a concerned resident and active member of my community. I support passing the Residential Info Project with Amendments 1 through 4 and 6 and without Amendment 7. Thank you for making time to discuss this important issue amid this moment of national crisis, and as a reminder that the protests against historic police brutality on Black and Brown people are connected to the same issues we discuss about our history of displacing Black and Brown Portlanders, systemic racism. I'm here to represent a generation that feels left behind by the economy and left out of the conversation. I am a renter living in constant fear of being priced out of my home with student loan debt that makes the possibility of owning a home unattainable for the foreseeable future, even though I have a stable job, good pay, and a master's degree. If I'm having this hard of a time keeping a roof over my head, how are others faring? My hint is that not well. Addressing our housing crisis requires a dynamic response with multiple solutions that will help to keep people off the streets and in housing they can afford. I strongly support RIP, which is setting a national example for progressive reform to low-density housing, because it is a carefully crafted, long-awaited reform projected to reduce displacement of low-income tenants and also reduce market rate housing prices at no cost to the public. It will make housing more affordable, assist in creating 15-minute neighborhoods that encourage biking and walking, and discourages urban sprawl by helping us live in more compact neighborhoods. These are all good for the environment and help us stay committed to our goals of making Portland greener. Undoing those racist land use patterns that made places like Eastmoreland exclusive and wealthy helps us bring back the diversity of mixed income housing to combat these years of inequitable policies. So thank you so much. We cannot stop here, as these reforms are only part of what the city must do to address it. And I hope you continue to turn to leaders like Portland Neighbors Welcome and develop meaningful long-term anti-displacement strategies. Thank you. I was trying to get it all in 2 minutes.
Good to hear from you. Thank you.
Take care.
Next is Sarah Ayanna Roan.
Good afternoon, Sarah.
Good afternoon, Portland City Council. As you know, my name is Sarah Ayanna Roan. I'm the Land Use and Transportation Chair of the Mount Scott Arleta neighborhood. We've submitted testimony in support of this project at a prior hearing and support the amendments forwarded by Portland Neighbors Welcome. I'm here on my own behalf today to reiterate that it's a long past time Portland reckons with the racism rampant in how we determine land uses in our city. Racism insidiously shapes conversations and decisions about livability, neighborhood character, and urban renewal, and it's the foundation on which our city's zoning is predicated. And in case folks don't think that policing, the Black Lives Matter movement, and land use zoning are related, I wanted to share some anecdotes today. A few nights ago, the protests headed into the West Hills. Police arrived on scene within 10 minutes. Such a swift response, it's almost as if they were trained to protect that precious enclave. And just this morning, the mayor was quick to call in police with armored vehicles to sweep from the street in front of his residence, an autonomous zone, named after Patrick Kimmins, who was killed in 2018 by Portland police, saying, "I want to state unequivocally, I absolutely do not support the autonomous zone. I believe it's a distraction from the larger movement, which is to support and uplift Black voices in our community." However, journalists on the ground reported that the march, the zone, and protest were all Black-led. Where was the timely, unequivocal rebuke of the formation of autonomous zones elsewhere in our city? Where was the outrage as residents of historic neighborhoods fought to establish their own autonomous zones free from police brutality, opposing multifamily housing in their affluent, mostly white, single-family neighborhoods? These attempts at reverse redlining and the fight against affordable housing in all areas of our city is a far greater distraction from racial justice than youth of color with some wooden pallets and important demands in the streets. We've taken too long to achieve too little with this process, and that's on the leadership, not the hundreds of community organizing hours that have gone into crafting this policy the last half decade. Let's get this done today, move on transforming our police bureau, our planning bureau, and the rest of our city government so we're community-led, anti-racist, and foregrounding affordability and anti-displacement rather than protecting and enhancing wealthy white autonomous zones in Portland. Thank you very much.
Next is Bandana Shrestha.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Hello. Thank you so much, Mayor Wheeler and commissioners. It's nice to be here. My name is Bandana Shrestha. I'm the Director of Community Engagement for AARP Oregon, and it's my privilege to offer these comments today on behalf of AARP. We did submit a written testimony from my state director, Ruby Houghton Pitts, that's on file, but I wanted to make sure to be here today because AARP has been tracking this issue and being an advocate on the comprehensive plan as well as the residential infill for the last 5 years. I don't think I need to go back and talk about how our population is aging. That's definitely happening. Oregon happens to be one of the states that's aging faster than many other places, even in the West. The other factor is that we are also becoming a more diverse state and a country. And I think the interest that this particular piece of this residential infill project offers is a great place to have shared interest for a lot of different groups of people, older adults, millennials, younger adults. People of color will all benefit from this great piece of legislation. And I particularly want to draw your attention to the five amendments that we support, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 6. When we started the process, there was no mention of visibility and accessibility. That was one of the things that we really focused on. We're glad that there is a visibility component to it. There still needs to be a lot more done because it's very minimal. And we hope that the city will be with us when we go to the state to see that kind of expansion happen so that we can have more visible and accessible homes. Similarly, in terms of just expanding housing options, that's going to benefit older adults, of course, but also young people who are looking for homes that they can afford or rent. And then the other piece of it is the affordability factor. You know, when you older adults look to downsize, they are hard-pressed to find smaller space homes and hard-pressed to find affordable homes. So residential infill project really has the opportunity. Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Bandana.
Next is Ernesto Fonseca.
Hello, Ernesto.
Greetings, Mayor Wheeler and commissioners. This is Kevin Kellogg. I'm the Director of Affordable Housing. I'm here on behalf of Ernesto Fonseca from Hacienda Community Development Corporation. He was not able to be here today. That's the third rescheduling, so I'm sorry that he's not here.
In this case, I will allow it. Thank you.
Thank you. Hacienda strongly supports your approval of the residential infill project. The RIP can advance our goals of diversifying and expanding the number of homes affordable to the communities we serve, ensuring the low-income homeowners, especially seniors and people of color, can retain the homes they own and remain part of the community. I wish to speak to you specifically on the benefits of Amendment 6 and its potential impact in the Cully neighborhood where we are based. Cully includes one of the most diverse census tracts in Oregon. The median family income is also significantly less than the city as a whole. The increased density allowed by the RIP will enable homeowners and affordable housing developers to produce smaller and more affordable homes on existing lots that provide much needed housing and also work to ward off the effects of gentrification. Amendment 6 is particularly useful to us, nonprofit organizations like Hacienda, because provisions of the additional FAR and allowance of additional units on a development site increases our ability to develop more homes for people earning under 60% of median and by leveraging traditional affordable housing development tools. This creates opportunity to build more units that are less expensive and more accessible to families who feel the burden of gentrification. In the next several years, Hacienda will increase opportunities for home ownership in Cully, and Amendment 6 will allow development at a density that reduces development costs for those new homes so they are affordable for modest income home buyers. Going forward, we're hopeful that the Anti-Displacement Task Force can advance other RIP policy recommendations offered by advocates, such as increasing the local subsidy for affordable housing development. As to Amendment 7, we agree with protecting historic neighborhoods. There are provisions for allowing all the density in historic neighborhoods by following the demolition review process. We hope the demolition review process does not become a tactic that is specifically used to prevent affordable housing from being added to historic neighborhoods.
Time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
The next person is Nick Sovey.
Hey, Nick.
Good afternoon, council members. This is Nick Sovey with Rose Community Development, and Rose has been working to improve outer southeast neighborhoods for three decades now. We encourage council to adopt the RIP with the amendments proposed by Portland Neighbors Welcome, including the affordability bonus. I know all of you on council care about affordable housing. The status quo is unacceptable. The private market is simply not providing housing for the vast majority of Portlanders. All over Rose's area, we're seeing $300,000 houses torn down and $700,000 houses being replaced. Added density would make it possible for nonprofits and other developers to compete for sites. So by voting yes, council will take an important step towards equity and for increasing housing opportunity for Portlanders.
Thank you, Nick. Appreciate it.
Diana Nunez.
Hi, Diana.
Good afternoon, Mayor Wheeler and City Commissioners. Thank you for this opportunity to testify on the amendments to the residential infill project. I'm Diana Nunez, Executive Director of Oregon Environmental Council. Oregon Environmental Council is a nonprofit, nonpartisan, membership-based organization that advances innovative, collaborative, and equitable solutions to Oregon's environmental challenges for today and future generations. OEC supports prompt adoption and implementation to the residential infill project. The residential infill project proposal is an opportunity to begin to change city policy shaping residential redevelopment over time to be more supportive of transit, biking, and walking for transportation, in addition to reducing greenhouse gas emissions and air pollution. It would allow more people the option to make home in close-in neighborhoods that are rich in access to jobs, services, schools, and other opportunities. Oregon Environmental Council strongly supports Amendment 6 because it would allow more density and support more affordability, amplifying the climate and affordability benefits of the original proposal. OEC opposes Amendment 7 because it would reduce allowed density and affordability. The residential infill project is a step towards a more equitable and sustainable city for all Portlanders. Oregon Environmental Council urges you to amend it with the Amendment 6 and to adopt and implement the amended proposal as soon as possible. OEC also urges you to consider this as a first step towards a future Portland where more people can live close to jobs, schools, services, stores, and community gathering places. The growing climate crisis and the housing affordability crisis demand swift, strong action. And this is the beginning, not just the end. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Next is Jeff Cole.
Hi, Jeff. Can you unmute? Star 6 if you've got a phone. Oh, there you are. Hi, Jeff.
I'm Jeff Cole. For Portland's working class families who perform essential functions, a close-in, single-family house would be a dream come true, where families hold barbecues, kids play, and you can hear the rain on the roof at night. Yet RIP, especially Amendment 6, is essentially more condos and apartments. Let's do better by supporting community land trusts and purchase outright existing single-family homes, making them available to families on an equity share basis well below market price. We'll create jobs by upgrading these homes with energy and earthquake retrofits, and more jobs with each house. Let's build an ADU. ADUs have been working great for Portland because they gently tuck in density by addition, not subtraction. The house is for the family, while the ADU becomes a long-term affordable rental. Funding such land trusts on any real scale, that's big money. Portland traded in the Mount Hood Freeway for light rail. Now we've got big ticket waterworks and roadworks that offer no housing relief. As to RIP itself, the potential demolition, division, displacement might not be worth the density. Triplex, quadplex, sixplex, the RIP subtext is code for a whole new context. It is a big risk, and not every change is exactly the change we need. In the past decade, Americans flocked to cities in large numbers. We cannot assume this trend will continue unabated on autopilot. Our single-family neighborhoods, handcrafted from old-growth timber, are assets of tremendous value that give Portland a long-term competitive advantage, a sense of place that's irreplaceable. Let's achieve true inclusion by offering working-class families the neighborhoods they want to live in because of the way they are today. Let's invest big in community land trust. Thank you, Mayor and Commissioners.
Thank you, Jeff. Appreciate it.
Next is Christopher Brown.
Hi, Christopher.
Hello. Thank you, Mayor, Wheeler, and Commissioners. I would like to address the obvious unfairness of the deeper affordability proposal to the poorest parts of Portland. In the last 4 years, Portland area voters have passed three measures worth over $1 billion for housing and homeless services. These three measures help to spread the cost of housing throughout the city. The deeper affordability measure will not cost the city as a whole anything. The cost is the impact on the neighbors that are closest to these apartments. The cost is the 5 extra feet in height that will allow 3 full stories of apartments and the ability to fill the entire lot except for 5 feet on the sides and the back and 10 feet on the front with a 35-foot-tall large building. There will be also outstanding stairs that will go up to the third floor apartments. This proposal, though well-intentioned, places the burden of housing on the poorest, least expensive, most racially diverse parts of town, not the city as a whole, but just those neighbors that live in close proximity to the allowed apartment buildings. The criteria to build one of these apartments is that the residential neighborhood in a residential neighborhood is based on the ability to buy the land and house and build 6 units, with 3 of the units that rent for approximately, what, $1,300 a month. The average lot in the Powellhurst Gilbert sells for $270,000. The average house in Lowellhurst sells for $780,000. An average house in the West Hills sells for $970,000. There's a $700,000 difference between the highest and the lowest. Powellhurst Gilbert is the most diverse of the three neighborhoods and is an example of where these buildings will be built and the only places. But therefore, placing the burden on the poor, more diverse neighborhoods. If we're thinking about race relations in Portland, why would we pass something as racist as this?
Time's up.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Next is Peggy Moretti.
Hi, Peggy.
Good afternoon. Thank you for letting me speak here. I'm Peggy Moretti, Executive Director of Restore Oregon. On the proposed amendments, Restore Oregon opposes Amendment Number 6, which effectively crams a small apartment building into a single-family lot and increases the financial motivation to demolish existing homes and cultural heritage. Restore Oregon strongly supports Amendment Number 7. It is essential that we disincentivize demolition in historic and conservation districts, which represent a mere 3% of the single-family housing. RIP incentivizes demolition everywhere else. We hear the housing advocates' concern, but this amendment is not about limiting housing choices. It's about protecting existing housing that is affordable and viable. Rather than restricting density, Restore Oregon urges an amendment to restrict access to the bonus based on FAR rather than housing types. Restore Oregon continues to be very concerned that RIP is going to cost Portland dearly while having no measurable impact on what really matters: affordability, housing for families, and homelessness. We support added density in historic and conservation districts, and we want to make that really clear, but we fear RIP, as it's being presented, will accelerate demolitions of existing affordable family-sized housing, erase cultural heritage, increase displacement, strain infrastructure, and release massive amounts of carbon emissions, an aspect that for some reason has not been factored into this debate. Restore Oregon is wrapping up a study on the CO2 impact of restoration and reuse. According to Eco Northwest, the retention and reuse of a 1,500 square foot house versus its demolition and replacement by a larger structure is equivalent to taking 93 cars off the road. Multiply this citywide and you have quite an impact. If our fears are unfounded, prove it. We can't help but compare this rush towards some other urban renewal schemes of the 1960s. And we hope at very least these unproven assumptions that are baked into RIP will be piloted before being rolled out citywide. And that there certainly should be a requirement to track and report the impact of RIP. And that that be part of its put in place before it's adopted. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next is Heather Flint Chateau.
Hello, thank you very much, Commissioners and Mayor. My name is Heather Flint Chateau, and I will be submitting my graphic presentation to you to look at it at your leisure. I want to say that I agree on many of these policy issues. I support missing middle housing, density, and infill, and agree we need to increase the diversity of units and types, legalizing internal conversions, duplexes, and plexes, and in principle, these are a good thing. I would encourage more support for programs and financial tools that would further incentivize internal conversions above the sort of baked-in incentivization for demolition. And I would absolutely agree with Commissioner Hardesty when you very eloquently said that your income should not determine your zip code. Because of past racist practices in our real estate, banking, and lending industries, I want to caution that we are not being additionally led at the forces of these racist institutions in past to further gentrify our city. Having been an activist and a professional planner for more than 20 years, an environmental planner, I'm deeply concerned about the carbon impacts associated with the demolitions that we are seeing. And what we are seeing is not producing affordable housing. So having lived through recent development around Division and really worked with communities to create more tools and bring people together around what we can do, I would just encourage that we really look at what the market is actually building, because we are seeing one single family house torn down and replaced by two $800,000 duplexes each over and over and over again. So just really want to make sure that we have a package of incentives and financial tools to help further the affordability goals that we have, and would encourage that you look at the recommendations from the Congress for New Urbanism with a package of financial tools and low interest loans, adaptive reuse incentives, encouraging tax as well. And can I just say one last thing, that I think that we are a city divided by income inequity and past injustices, but we are also a city of bridges, and that we are building something here that needs more work before it has the full strength of the people to make this a stronger and more robust policy that will bring us together instead of divide us even more. Thank you.
Thanks, Heather.
Next is MK Hansen.
Hello, MK.
Hi there. I would like to ask if the clerk can at least enable video for me to chime in with some slides. I think it's pretty critical to this discussion that I'd be able to show some things.
Carla, is that a possibility?
Keelan, can we do that? I don't know if we offered that to the other.
I integrated it as a part of my Zoom backgrounds to make it easier and more flexible. But my testimony really sort of revolves around the work that I do, which is a lot of mapping and cross-referencing. And I keep waiting for people in the city and in the Planning Sustainability Commission to actually do this work to bust some of these false narratives. And it hasn't happened, and it's the 11th hour. And I would much rather just quickly cycle through some of these maps that graphics with affordability, with also a suppressed document.
Sorry, Mayor, should we be timing this, or are we going to allow the slides if we can? Keelan, could you let me know if we can allow that first?
I'd like to hear from legal counsel. Is there any objection to us seeing the slides?
Carla, can you confirm, were other participants allowed to submit testimony in advance video that they could show? I know sometimes we do that.
Not that I remember, but I'm not sure if anybody asked. Keelan, can you verify on that?
Right. We didn't get any requests ahead of time, but we have in the past shown slides for people who have provided testimony.
And that the ability to do that was available. People could have requests, you just didn't receive any.
Right. And then what we've done in the past is we have asked to receive the slides ahead of time, and then I would share the screen. This is a little different in that the person is requesting to share their screen.
I would like to request to see the slides.
Okay, and that's a technical question whether or not.
If the mayor would allow it.
Yeah.
Technically speaking, also, that's the reason why I actually put these slides as my Zoom background, so that I can switch the visual background. We don't have to hit up against any technical issues. I'm not showing a video or sharing my screen. And also as a side note, this is mapping data that I use that is sourced from city data. So this is just using ArcGIS and pulling those layers in and cross-referencing demographics and zoning and illustrating the truth on the ground through city data rather than my own perspective or opinion.
Thank you, MK. So legal counsel commissioner Udaly is requesting it. I'm not hearing you say that we should not allow it. Is that correct?
If Keelan is able to make that happen, then that's fine. I will note that in order for the testimony, those images to be included in the record, they do need to be submitted to the council clerk. It is not part of the record by showing. It has to be submitted.
Yeah, I would love to do that for posterity as well.
Okay.
From a technical perspective, if it is integrated with your Zoom background, I believe you should be able to just show that.
Yep.
Are you able to see it, council?
No.
Yeah,
no.
I think you have to, I was only able to join this, I think you probably have to enable me to be able to join by video.
We're on the subject, I'm getting a text message from my staff saying, can MK and all commenters please submit the slideshow to the Map App project for the residential infill project. Staff read through the materials. If she can submit, we can follow along through the Map App.
Okay, I just promoted MK to a panelist. MK, you should have the ability now. Okay,
yeah, it looks like it. But how do we get it on the, to be big?
Yeah, now I'm small. Now I need a speaker view full screen. Let's see if
you click speaker view in the top right-hand corner, your screen should go from gallery to speaker.
But everyone has to click speaker view.
That's right.
Yeah, not just the presenter.
All right, so let me know when you guys have that. I think that's something you guys have to do and not me, right?
Yeah, if council can hit speaker view.
I'm sorry, where is that?
It's up in the right-hand corner. There should be, it's either gallery view or
yeah, it was hidden behind the participant list. I keep the participant list up so I can see if my colleagues are raising their hand. So I'll put that down and I will hit speaker view, and it looks like I see Keelan's screen at the moment.
And Mayor, I have a big picture of you on my screen, so I'm not going to
you, Commissioner. Look at that.
Yeah. I think once MK starts talking, she will have the screen.
Okay, I'm talking. I know you can hear me, but
yes, it's working.
It's working. You can see me full screen now?
Yes.
All right, because I'm just seeing me tiny screen, but that's okay. All right, so thank you for the indulgence. And again, part of the work that I do and part of the frustration in the many years I've been following this is the difference between what's called reification and the truth on the ground. Reification, sort of a Marxist term for misleading people into mistaking the map for the territory. So the first slide that you see here is basically kind of the narrative of the RIP and the importance of it in terms of how this sort of bifurcated narrative has publicly led folks to believe that not only is zoning, calling it single family zoning, rather than low density zoning, but that everything pretty much in those zones excludes diverse multifamily housing types and sort of predicated on this narrative that we need to upzone in order to allow folks of lower income and folks who have been historically excluded, redlined, et cetera. So first, this is the actual zoning. And by virtue of the comp plan, and by virtue of overlays in certain zones that allow for even greater density than RIP, but large global private equity development does not like to have to develop according to different community plans. It likes to what I call tabula rasa planning, which is being able to mass produce and not being beholden to the intricacies of different districts. So this is what actual zoning permits. And I've color coded this in terms of density, units per square foot, and equalized it and normalized it. So this represents existing multifamily housing that exists on the ground. This is a density map of that. So using expensive ArcGIS software and algorithms to not only plot those multifamily units, but also by virtue of how many units are in those particular buildings to give us a heat map of existing density on the ground in
time is up.
I'm sorry? In terms of existing
time is up.
This is what will happen. This is what it looks like for a median family households and market rate. This is for a single family household. Everything in red is basically priced out. And this is for a family of four. And that's what RIP is about, is redevelopment at market rate, period.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Mm-hmm.
Next, we're going to go with, looks like, did Heather? She talked, I believe. Let's go with Sam Noble.
Hello, Sam.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, so I submitted a slide to the clerk prior to the first hearing. If she still has it, there's a point in my talk when I'd like to ask for it. Previous presenter got me a little confused about whether that's still available to me. But if it's all right, I'd like to proceed. My name's Sam Noble. I live on Mount Tabor. I want to first make a statement in support of the Deeper Affordability Amendment. This is really important because it's the only viable path towards opening up subsidized housing development in the exclusive single family areas where rezoning is politically unrealistic. I hope you won't stop here, though. Please follow up with the real anti-displacement policies that don't kneecap our housing supply. Please also rezone the off-corridor, close-in areas of the city that can offer extremely short commutes and access to other amenities. Further, I'd like you to reject Amendment Package 7, the so-called historic resource demolition disincentive, predicated on the same dubious logic which claims that an extra kitchen is so incredibly valuable that it'll lead to wholesale redevelopment of the entire city. Your economic modeling tells us that few fourplexes will be built in close-in neighborhoods full of valuable single-family houses. That is to say that units 3 and 4 don't provide an overwhelming economic redevelopment incentives. By contrast, we do know that there's a strong market for single-family houses in the amenity-rich conservation and historic districts. So this is where, if you have it, I'd like the clerk to display my slide.
One moment. I'm pulling it up.
Okay, so in conservation districts, almost anyone who wants to demolish a small house can do so. Imposing demolition review in order to build 3 and 4 unit buildings just means that the better redevelopment outcome is less profitable than 1-for-1 replacement. In air quotes, single dwelling zones, the 3rd and 4th unit aren't bonuses. This code change explicitly provides bonus floor area to encourage these extra units because the Planning Commission and 3 of you see these extra units as a public good in and of themselves. That's because they're smaller and more affordable than any new or newly renovated old house. Neil Heller made a really great illustration on the economics behind renovation and redevelopment in single dwelling zones. And that's what you're looking at now. I think some of you have seen this before. The reason to reject this amendment is that it doesn't change the demolished preserve decision. It just eliminates the less expensive outcomes. And that's my testimony. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate it, Sam.
Next, we'll go with Barbara Kerr.
Good afternoon, Barbara.
Good afternoon, council members. My name is Barbara Kerr. I have worked with the United Neighborhoods for Reform, but I am speaking today as a very concerned citizen. The residential infill project needs to be redirected, not amended. Not only does new construction have a greater carbon footprint, but existing homes can provide density more affordably with the flexibility to meet more people's needs. At an affordability level that is more of our deeper affordability that new construction cannot offer. Houses can be divided, they can provide house sharing, ADUs, room rentals, attic studios, etc. For many houseless people, a room to rent can be healthier and more normalizing than public housing. Demolition removes starter and fixer-upper homes. Existing houses embody family, neighborhood, and cultural history bonds, especially for minority communities that sustain us more than ever in times of crisis. Destroying houses displaces people even if they stay in the same neighborhood. Support communities are broken up when not all neighbors can afford the new development and the units are too small for families to share. Elders need the option to age in place by renting space in their homes, not be isolated in small apartments or plexes. Even while providing density, nearly all existing homes have personal outdoor space for growing food, for kids to play and learn, and for keeping spirits up with social distancing. They can provide solar, wind, and rainwater resources to help keep costs down. We need a healthy mix of owner-occupied and rental homes. Multiple unit new construction puts ownership in the hands of fewer people, widening the social equity gap. In times of economic hardship, the rich get richer at the expense of the poor. Existing houses and buildings enable startups and resilience for small business, which young people and people who are losing their jobs really need. Racism in Portland is underpinned by housing policies like the RIP that promote demolition. Regulations that support creative reuse can achieve density while preserving intergenerational wealth. Asking disenfranchised communities to accept newly built apartments and flexes in buildings they could rarely afford to buy prolongs intergenerational poverty. We disrespect the struggles and accomplishments of the families in the Black community by destroying homes and buildings, no matter how humble, that embody and carry the stories to the next generations. The built environment reminds us to honor that history and learn from it. Do we not care what has been happening to Portland's Black communities in this wave of 21st century urban renewal? Did anyone ask the displaced if they wanted what the RIP assumes is better housing? Has this city enabled new construction to get to the point when the minority community leaders are willing to accept the RIP as lesser of two evils, either housing that is affordable to white out-of-staters or housing
that
the middle class is subsidized?
Thank you. Appreciate it, Barbara.
Thank you.
Next is Brian Hoop.
Hi, Brian.
Good afternoon, dear Mayor Wheeler and fellow commissioners. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. I'm Brian Hoop, Executive Director of Housing Oregon. Housing Oregon is a membership-based statewide association of affordable housing community development corporations committed to serving and supporting low-income Oregonians across the housing needs spectrum from homeless to homeowner. And quickly on another issue, I first want to thank you for your courageous vote on the police budget yesterday and for Commissioner Hardesty's leadership. Our board voted 2 days ago to endorse the calls for action from the Coalition of Communities of Color and Portland African American Leadership Forum, and you moved too quick for me to get a letter in. As we testified back in January, Housing Oregon supports a deeper affordability amendments. And while the Residential Info Project overall expands the potential of developing affordable family-sized homes, especially for those in the 60 to 80% area median income range, the deeper affordability amendment provides a path forward to serving more households with less subsidy and or serving households at lower incomes below 60% AMI. These increased densities translate to reducing the cost per unit for developers to create below market housing, serving more households with less subsidy and serving households at lower incomes. This will make it feasible for nonprofit developers like Hacienda CDC and Rose CDC, who spoke earlier, to be able to make such developments pencil out. So while there's more to do with the development or the funding of the anti-displacement measures, the time has come to approve the residential infill project and deeper affordability amendments. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you.
Next is Alan Field.
Hi, Alan. You're still muted there, Alan. There you go.
Okay, here I am. Good afternoon, Mayor and Commissioners. This is Alan Field. I support the provision for allowing for internal conversions, which is in line with the goal to create greater unit types and diverse housing opportunities in more neighborhoods across the city. But I oppose the blanket rezoning of Portland without better anti-demolition tools and public engagement. This should not be done outside the comp plan. As Commissioner Fritz has pointed out, there is more than enough building capacity under the existing zoning to absorb the expected population influx over the next 30 years. Market forces have so far and will continue under this proposal to cause development to be built along our neighborhood corridors for the high-end market and will only increase rents. This will not address affordability and only exacerbate it. I encourage council to direct staff to decouple the very contentious rezoning provisions of this proposal from the less controversial provisions allowing for internal conversions. I support Amendment 7 for disincentivizing demolition, but there needs to be an additional amendment to add incentives and tools to encourage internal conversions. Thank you for giving me this time.
Thanks, Alan.
I skipped. Frank DeMarco is next.
Oh, okay. Hey, Frank. Welcome. Frank, you're still muted.
Bye. Okay,
there you are.
Better? Yeah. Okay, thank you. Good afternoon. I'm Frank DeMarco, and thank you, Mayor and City Council members, for a two-minute opportunity to try to give voice to the tens of thousands of Portland residents who oppose RIP, but also support fair ideas for making Portland a more affordable place to live for everyone. We all know the controversial origins of RIP, hatched between a former mayor and the BPS, followed by a developer-dominated committee process, and now being sold like a box of laundry detergent to Portland citizens. Experts have testified that RIP will have little or no effect on affordability. Indeed, experts have also testified that RIP will displace many vulnerable citizens it is alleged to help. And yet, these testimonies have been ignored, and the bulldozer of this well-meaning but deeply flawed measure rumbles on. RIP is a poison pill for Portland neighborhoods and far too important to be decided by a shorthanded city council in the middle of a health pandemic and an unprecedented period of social reform that requires your daily attention. And we all appreciate the work you've been doing. Therefore, today I'm calling on this city council to pass a measure placing RIP on the November 2020 ballot and giving Portland residents the rights of self-determination of both density and the destiny of their city. It is okay to park this bulldozer. If you vote on anything, vote to give all Portland citizens these rights with a ballot measure on RIP this November. And thank you.
Thank you, Frank. Appreciate your perspective. Thank you for being here.
Next is Kristen Miner.
Hi, Kristen.
Hello, thank you. I'm speaking today on behalf of the Portland Historic Landmarks Commission. We are in strong support of RIP and also in strong support of Amendment 7, which is the Historic Resource Demolition Disincentive. Because many of the previous speakers appear to be against this amendment, I would like to actually address some serious misconceptions about it. First off, where does it apply? Many previous testifiers kept mentioning Irvington or Ladd's, but the amendment does not apply to historic districts. It only applies to conservation districts, all of which are located in North and Northeast Portland. This area of Portland, which was and maybe still is the center of the African American community, has experienced two decades of intense demolition and gentrification. But if there is ever going to be a push for right of return for people with ties to North and Northeast Portland, we should be supporting the history and story of this community. One example is Cleo Davis, who came in front of you last year to save his family's house, the Mayo House in Elliott Conservation District. Second, to everyone calling for more density, this amendment still allows for significantly more density, and I might add different types of density as well, on any of these properties. I know developers don't want to work around and add onto an existing structure, but we can do this. It's worth it. Demolition increases displacement and moves us further from our climate goals. Plus, if you leave it to the market, the most affordable houses will continue to be torn down. Let's work on increasing density, especially in North and Northeast Portland. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kristen.
Next is John Wood.
Good afternoon, John.
Greetings, Mayor and City Commissioners. My name is John Wood, and I speak in opposition to the RIP in most part. I hope it does not come to mean rest in peace, Portland. I think our historic homes and neighborhoods are much of what gives the city living in Portland desirable, and I hope that we can maintain as much of that as possible. I come to this as a longtime affordable housing advocate. I once directed what's now Transition Projects in the 70s, and I headed the Northwest District Association's Housing Committee and a CDC there. I oppose Amendment 6 while supporting Amendment 7. I realize the goal of making affordable housing in all neighborhoods is desirable, but I don't think encouraging demolition of old homes is the way to do this. I'd encourage more internal conversion as things discussed before. I would have preferred a true infill model of additions and ADUs to existing homes. I'm not convinced by the displacement study that most of the demolition will occur in Brentwood, Darlington, Lentz, and Montevilla, or the allowing more units, it will decrease demolition elsewhere. I believe that developers will continue to purchase homes in the inner ring of older residential neighborhoods because homes will come up for sale there, and they want those are the neighborhoods where developers can make the most money. So I want to add that my main those that are requesting that that there's inclusive studies not only of the houses lost, but of the large trees that are lost. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Next is Anna Eaton.
Hi, Anna. Anna, you're still muted.
Commissioners, Mayor, can you hear me?
Yes, now we can. Thank you.
My name is Anna Eaton. I was born in Portland 65 years ago, and I live in my family home that was purchased by my grandparents in 1938 in Southeast Portland. My first concern has not for the Portland is that city. The city never held contractors to their promise and request by the city that have built constructions in the neighborhoods of Portland. In the past 10 years, there's been multiple apartment buildings go up that still to this day are unoccupied, have unoccupied units because the rents are so high that the majority of people living in Portland cannot afford them. Fixing that would help immensely. My second concern is that I would like to emphasize my support for the historic demo disincentive, although I do not believe that it sufficiently safeguards Portland's historic buildings. I would rather see Portland's historic buildings completely off limits to demolition and developer. My third concern is that I truly believe and ask that this entire project should go to a vote for the people that live and have businesses in Portland. I also believe that due to COVID-19, current and upcoming elections, and the current demonstrations and riots in Portland, this is not a good time to be pushing forward such an important issue such as land use within the city limits with so many other stressful factors going on, and not properly including all citizens of Portland by presenting the entire process to them and letting them vote on it. The city of Portland, I would like to see be creative and encouraging developers to be creative and spending its time and energy and monies on creating another city that is new age, environmentally conscientious, with all their new products that newcomers would love to live in on the outskirts of Portland, such as Forest Grove, Highway 30, St. Helens, McMinnville, Damascus, Estacada. There is plenty of available space to make lots of housing available. I don't understand why we are tearing down buildings and making huge waste and in Portland city limits. Why keep trying to overcrowd and destroy quaint Portland? There has already been too much and gone too far. We have enough units and houses, lower the rent so people can afford them.
Thank you. Commissioner Daly had a question or a comment.
That was a few commenters back, Mayor.
I apologize, Commissioner. All right. I didn't see it. I apologize. I was on the attendee screen still, so I didn't shift to the panelist. I'm
no
sorry.
No problem. I can follow up.
Very good. Next individual, please.
I shall Linda Nedokovin.
Good afternoon, Linda.
Good afternoon, Mayor Wheeler and commissioners. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. And because I have you captive, I want to thank you again for all the hard work and very thoughtful effort you have just expended to better align our city's budget with the values we aspire to, but too often fall short of meeting. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And now some brief comments on RIP. Thank you also for addressing the need for evaluation and tracking measures before you implement these major code changes. Many of us have raised that issue. Second, in regard to the potential displacement impacts, please make sure there is ongoing funding, perhaps not just from the city, but from somewhere, for the community-led anti-displacement efforts, along with mitigation strategies being ready to be utilized if the need arises. Finally, I'll only talk about Amendment 7 in my verbal testimony. I live in an historic district, and this amendment is trying to discourage demolition of historic structures in conservation districts, promoting adaptive reuse and increased density via internal conversions and external ADUs, and that those external conversions, if we can change building codes and other things, are going to help regular historic districts as well. And third, by advancing sustainability goals by keeping that embodied energy in those houses where it belongs instead of in the landfill. This approach has played an important role in the evolution of my neighborhood over many decades. We keep adding ADUs and we have a lot of conversions, but of course those would have been illegal under current zoning, hence we need to change. Some of those speaking against Amendment 7 see it as a ploy to avoid building middle housing. It's not been the case in my neighborhood. If you think this amendment has a loophole, then please work with the community to fix it so we can do better at achieving these goals. Perhaps fine-tuning as part of the Historic Resources Code update would be a logical approach. I want to stress what I'm really here to ask for is help with the economic segregation issue. I raise it again and again. My neighborhood, we're tearing down the small structures. We're replacing them with the more expensive ones. That means new neighbors who are of a different income level than the people we have lost or displaced. And there's no way to keep this mixed income character that is so important to the neighborhood that I have come to love. I fear that there will be an acceleration of this trend toward gentrification, and a lot of our asset-rich inner city neighborhoods are not going to become available to people that have a right and an interest in taking advantage of these things. I'm also concerned about ownership options.
Time is up.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I believe that is the last person who signed up, Mayor.
All right. Very good. So thank you to everybody who provided testimony. Again, members of the public who'd like to submit additional written testimony can do so until 8 p.m. tonight by visiting the project website. So colleagues, first of all, I'd like to ask if you have any questions for staff or if you'd like to discuss any of the proposed amendments.
Well, I wanted to ask Kristen Miner some follow-up questions, but maybe Commissioner Britz can help with this. I appreciated her clarifying Amendment 7. I believe this is an amendment that resulted from a conversation that Commissioner Fritz and I had, and it was really just meant as a stopgap measure. Commissioner Fritz, could you fill in my blank spot on what we intended this to cover and confirm it was a temporary fix?
Thank you, Commissioner Daly. Yes, that's, well, it's, yes, it's certainly, it's a first do no harm fix. I'm sorry?
It's been so long since we have.
No, you did, you're right. It's a first do no harm amendment to wait until we do the historic resources update. And it is also the same as what we did in Better Housing by Design. So it merely applies the same standards. And the issue is that you don't have demolition review in the conservation districts and the way you do in the historic districts. But I noticed that Kristen Miner is back on, so she may be able to amplify what I just said.
Great, thank you. Yes, and I believe what we were trying to solve for is if the historic resources update, if we don't make this amendment and the historic resources update guides us to do something different, then that would be a taking that we would have to pay for. Is that correct?
That's correct. You can always give, but you can't take away. Yeah. So if we move ahead without having that information, then we can't go back on it.
And do we know when we expect the historic resources update to be complete? Of course, the world being turned upside down, that may not, it might not be on track.
Let's ask Kristen that question.
Okay.
Thank you for asking, Commissioner Udaly. This is, can you hear me?
Yes.
Kristen? Okay. Excellent. And I don't have a great answer for your question about when the Historic Resources Code project is going to be finished. I do know that Brandon Spencer Hartle, who's leading that project, is expecting to come in front of my commission with some updates to it, I believe, in just a couple of months. So it is starting again. You know, that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to, you know, be a fast process.
But it is in progress. So it's, yes, it's not like it's not years. It's probably months.
Correct.
Okay, thank you. I just needed to refresh my memory because that conversation happened so long ago. And our intent is not to deny benefits of RIP to property owners who are in conservation districts. It's just to preserve our ability to implement any changes recommended by that update. Okay, I got it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you, Mayor. I think it would be helpful since we have staff here today to review the amendments that are under consideration. If I remember, and just like Commissioner Udaly, we've been doing this for a long time. And so I think it would be helpful just to have a mini review of each of the amendments that have been proposed, because is it true that when we meet again, we will be considering adopting those 7 amendments. Is that accurate?
Yes, we'll be back on July 1st and we'll go through each amendment separately for your consideration and vote. Just by way of sort of high-level quick summary of those amendments. So you may recall amendments one were highly technical in nature, fixing clerical errors essentially and bringing our project up to speed with other adopted changes that had happened. Amendment two dealt with
housing by design, so connecting those two. Got it.
Thank you. Number two had to do with Senate Bill 534 and changes relating to the developability of platted lots, the historically narrow lots. Number three was related to aligning our allowances for duplexes to better align with the House Bill 2001 requirements that require the duplexes be allowed on any lot where a house is allowed. Amendment four was a streamlining amendment to consolidate two processes, a property line adjustment and a lot consolidation into a single replat process. It's sort of related.
And if I remember, they were different zoning on different sides of the property and we were trying to align it. Is that accurate?
Well, that's more what Amendment 1 was, correcting some map issues. Amendment 4 is really about if you've got these historically narrow lots and you want to take four of them and make them three, there's a convoluted process to do that now, and this would just make that easier. So we have wider lots, and it just simplifies that process. So the first four are really kind of technical in nature. Amendment 5 was the non-amendment that related to infrastructure, and you had a conversation yesterday about changes to LTIC that was somewhat related to that. Amendment 6, you've heard a lot about. So that's the deeper affordability bonus amendment, 50% of units affordable at 60% MFI. Two of the units required to be visitable. And Amendment 7, I'm glad that Kristen provided a better summary of that amendment. It is pretty narrow in its scope in terms of applying only in conservation districts. It is sort of a stopgap measure between this project and the Historic Resources Code. It aligns with better housing.
You are wonderful, Morgan. That was perfect. That's exactly what I needed because it all comes back.
I live and breathe this every day.
Go ahead, Commissioner.
I was just going to say, Mayor, I have no additional questions. I just thought it would be probably helpful for both the public and for us to just have a mini refresher course.
That's not unwise. Morgan, I want to build on that last question that was asked. The Amendment 7, and we've obviously honed in on this as sort of a critical amendment. In my notes, my recollection was staff had indicated that the passage of that amendment would, in the near term, make it easier for internal conversions and retrofits without wholesale demolition. Can you explain that?
I would say it doesn't make it necessarily easier for internal conversions, but internal conversions are still a possibility. So you can
convert
existing structures into triplexes, fourplexes, add additional ADUs and so forth.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that clarification. Very good. And then amendment 5 is related to the LTIC conversation we had yesterday, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, good. So those two dovetail well.
Yeah, as you may recall, we had proposed early on a concept that would further limit triplexes, fourplexes, et cetera, on streets that lacked a curb. We heard a lot of concern about that approach and worked with our infrastructure partners to look at expanding LTIC to address that infrastructure issue.
Okay, and to focus a little more in a more detailed manner on that, with RIP and then the linkage back to the LTIC program as we discussed yesterday, that could in fact help us leverage private investment in public infrastructure. Could you explain that in a little detail?
Yeah, so what happens now frequently is when we have a condition where the street is underimproved and a development application comes in, if the street improvement requirements are disproportionate to the level of impact, meaning they're not, you can't justify the cost of those improvements, then what PBOD and BES and water are in the situation of waiving the improvement requirements entirely. So we don't get the improvements and we don't get any financing associated with that development. So what LTIC does is it provides a a charge for when development occurs on those underimproved streets. And remember, for residential infill, we're differentiating gravel streets or sort of off the table. So specific to streets that have a paved surface, but may lack a curb and or sidewalk. In those conditions, the applicant or developer can pay the LTIC charge, which goes into a fund that's collected, and those funds are then committed to improvements along particular streets that follow an allocation methodology that PBOT has adopted.
Yeah, good. Okay, good. And I'm really pleased with the work that BES and BDS did that on this particular amendment. And my staff and I have spent a considerable amount of time on this with social equity and environmental justice advocates, affordable housing developers. And it looks like this LTIC linkage, it's, I think, a good strategic and it's good equitable approach. So I really appreciate the work that went into this. And
I'd like to also
commend. I know PBOT had a key role in this as well. So yeah. I just want to acknowledge and thank everybody for their partnership to make that work. It's taken me a while to get my hands around it completely, but I think that's a really good solution.
If I might, Mayor, I don't agree with that. It means that the people living in these new homes will never have a developed street in front of their house. And so it means that in terms of visitability, that wheelchair users, bikes, etc., will not likely be able to use a lot of these streets. It will promote, it does get money into the fund to improve other streets, but it the new residents then don't have any obligation to help fix their own street.
Morgan, how would you respond to that criticism?
Well, I think there's a bigger question at play here that's beyond RIP, right? It's the backlog of unimproved streets that we've inherited through annexation of properties, areas from the county. So we have about 370 miles of unimproved and underimproved streets with a price tag of about $1.5 billion. So the bigger question here really is, how do we bring those streets up to fully improved status? And the challenge is by our previous attempts to do that, we had local improvement districts, which put the burden on adjacent property owners. We had waivers of remonstrance, which were rather ineffective at getting LIDs formed. We can do capital projects, which is a cost to the general fund. Or the LTIC is a way of collecting funds to incrementally improve streets along the way. It would take an absolute redevelopment of all the lots on all those unimproved streets, paying the LTIC for all those streets to be improved. So Commissioner Fritz's concern about some streets not being brought up to a fully improved condition, absent some other funding source or program or directive, that is correct. So there's a further large outstanding issue that's sort of challenged our city since we've annexed these areas. And like other people have already testified, RIP is a step towards the right direction. It's not the solution for everything.
Okay, and I appreciate your honesty and transparency on that. Commissioner Fritz and Commissioner Udaly.
Thank you, and let me be clear. I was part of doing the LTIC in the first place, and I support it. I think it is a strategy to help with some streets, and that PBOT has done an amazing job of implementing it. I just had a thought. One of my concerns is if you're going to get developments, as was mentioned in Laurelhurst or somewhere else, where the new homes, even if there's six of them on a lot, are likely to be extremely expensive. It seems to me that in that, of course, Laurelhurst has many finished streets. But my concern is that we should not be exempting developers who are going to put in high-end housing from doing the street improvements. So is there a way to further encourage and incent affordable housing by linking the ability to do it only if you're going to use the affordable housing bonus?
I'm not sure I followed that question.
So the infrastructure amendment was a way to it's originally said you can't do these infill housing on unless you have a street. And I understand the need and desire to allow these housing types in Cully and other places where the streets, you know, we've been hearing for a long time are not improved and not likely to be improved. What if we had a modification that you could, you're not allowed to develop on undeveloped streets unless you're going to be doing an element of affordable housing?
I think that's within the purview of council to amend the, or to alter the amendment, to further constrain the types of housing that's allowed. But I think what we heard from our community partners and folks in the affordable housing, folks that provide affordable housing, is that providing for these additional housing types throughout Portland neighborhoods, even if they are not quote unquote affordable, regulated affordable housing, that is at 80% MFI or lower, still provides a benefit to lower cost housing for Portlanders overall. So it's the alternative, if we're putting that kind of constraint on the type of development that happens on the lots, is it's more frequently more economically palatable to just develop larger single family homes instead.
Well, we've been struggling that this project was not initially intended to be directed to affordable housing. And then we made lots, the current comprehensive plan has enough housing capacity of all types. So since we've made some, I think, good modifications to encourage affordable housing, is there a way to link this in as well so that we don't get developers who are going to develop expensive housing getting a pass from the improving the street?
So maybe I can add to this conversation a little bit, Commissioner Fritz. I don't think the choice is between a street with a full sidewalk on the whole block. What happens is if a street does not have any improvement and a fourplex would be built there, and if we said that's market housing, therefore they need to build improvements on front of the house, that is building improvements right in front of that site, and it's a sidewalk leading to nowhere, right? We've seen this time and time again, little pieces of sidewalk that is in front of one house and then there isn't a sidewalk to connect to. So I don't think the choice is between a full sidewalk on one side and having no sidewalk at all. What we're talking about is a sidewalk in front of a fourplex that leads to nowhere. That's one option. Or paying into the LTIC funds, which is the city collecting funds to build sidewalks where it makes more sense and where we can collectively put the funds so that they can be used in a place where near a school, for example, for our Safe Rights to School program. So I just wanted to lend that perspective.
And as usual, Sandra, you make perfect sense, and I withdraw my suggestion. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good discussion. Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Udaly?
Thank you, Mayor. I really just wanted to add a little to this conversation, which is that LTIC is actively developing complete streets in Cully, Outer Southeast, and on the Southwest Corridor. And we came up with a solution with community advocates in the impacted communities, in particular Cully, who really didn't really wanted this fix. And if we don't do it, it means that the people there, not only will the sidewalk not be developed, but we won't get more housing. So I really support this amendment and hope that we can include it. Or it's not an amendment. It's a non-amendment. Whatever. I hope we can pass it.
Very good. Thank you. All right. Any other, let's say Commissioner Daly. You just had your hand up still, sorry. Okay, are there any other further questions or statements from my colleagues? Hearing no further questions or statements, I want to thank staff who've worked really hard to make it both easy to listen and engage in this process. I want to thank you for that, particularly our Smart Cities PDX staff. Good work. I also want to thank innovative thinkers in our community for working with the city staff to add a tool to the toolkit to address some of these issues. I'll now turn it over to our BPS staff to talk about what the next steps are.
Thank you, Mayor. So as you noted at the start of this hearing, written testimony may continue to be submitted to our MAP app online or by emailing the council clerk up until 8 o'clock tonight. That website, ready for it, www.portland.gov/BPS/RIP. Okay, we will close the record for written testimony tonight at 8 o'clock, and council will then return on July 1st at 2 p.m. To vote on the amendments, and we'll walk you through those one by one.
All right, thanks, Morgan. Thank you. That concludes today's hearing. As a reminder, the record closes today at 8 p.m., and as Morgan just mentioned, council will discuss and vote on the amendments on July 1st at 2 p.m. Time certain. Be there. We are adjourned. Thank you, everyone.